here you go. Yeah, I think he did. I think he did a few years ago.
Okay, Tobin.
Okay, so if everybody, I just put the Al Hanisim's Happy Hanukkah, Tobin, on one side, and then on the other side to start with the some of the sheer material.
So
I wanted to just read carefully through Al Hanisim. Try to read it very carefully. Really do that the first half of this year, and then to try to put it in a little bit of perspective based on one passage in the Gemara, the central defining passage in the Gemara about Hanukkah, and then to finish off with a perspective from the Rambam. So really just three things: the Al Hanisim, the brief passage from the Gemara, and then something that I think emerges from the Rambam. So Ari, do you mind just reading the first the Al Hanisim for Hanukkah and then the Al Hanisim for Purim?
Sure.
It's just one point of introduction is that, like many things in Torah, but many things in life, these aren't meant to be understood in isolation. It's my view that the Al Hanisim is actually meant to be understood one in light of the other. It's sort of like two sides of a coin, which is why you'll recall that the opening two lines are actually the same for both. Alanisim Vela Porkan Vela Gvuris, etc. And then we differentiate. But they're actually, you know, they're always sort of, even, you know, structurally speaking, in the Siddur, they appear right next to each other. And that's meant to, I think, be, as you can see, the one for Hanukkah is considerably longer, which I think is also part of the story. But just keep that in mind, that they're really two sides of a coin.
B'mei Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai Uvanav. So in the days of Matityahu, son of Yochanan, high priest, and his children from the Chashmonai family, Keshamdam Malchut Yavan Harsha'al Amchai Yisrael, when the wicked Greek kingdom stood up against the Jewish people, Lashkicham Toratecha, to make them forget their Torah, Ulahaviram Mechukei Ritzonecha, and to have them veer from the statutes that you wanted, you Hashem wanted them to keep. Vata berechamecha harabim, and you with great mercy amadeta lahem be'et saratam.
Okay, so let's hold it up there. So, and then God in His mercy stood for them in this time of distress. Okay, so vata berechamecha harabim. Okay, Ari, do you mind just taking us through now the one on Purim? We'll come back and finish it. You'll see why. I just wanted to stop it there for a second. Okay.
B'mei Mordechai ve'Esther b'Shushan Habira.
Okay, so we could follow sort of that. Right, you could. It's not to be like, you know, masters in Renaissance literature to know that, okay, there's a structural parallel.
And then
get Marv Levy in here for
also,
a little
analysis. And also the standing, yeah.
Right.
Kisha'amara lehem.
Okay, very good.
Haman harasha.
Right, which is Kisha'amda malchus yavan harasha, Kisha'amara lehem haman harasha.
And
okay,
in both
wait,
cases,
it's like, okay.
And then the intent is spelled out.
Okay, good. So this is the interesting part.
So here the intent, it says, Bikesh lahashmid laharogu la'abed. Different words for destroying and killing.
Right.
At Kol Hayudim, all Jews, Minarva Atzakein, all ages, Taf v'nashim b'yom echad, Taf is babies,
mm-hmm.
and then the women all in one day. Just tell me where to stop.
Yeah, we're going to just go through to the end here. Just
B'shlosha asar lechodesh shneim asar, 13th day of the 12th month, hu chodesh Adar, the month of Adar, ushlalam lavos, and to take all of their possessions. Presumably the possessions of the Jews at that part. Va'ata berachamecha harabim.
That phrase is
atzata, the same.
Exactly the same as we had in Hanukkah.
So you and your great mercy, you know, thwarted his intentions, vokokalkta machshavto, and destroyed his thoughts. Vashevoto lo gemulo birosho. V'taluoto v'etmanav ala itz.
Okay, so God's mercy is demonstrated by the thwarting of Haman's plan and his intent, and of course...
Everything he wanted to do happened right. to him, and he and his sons were hung.
Okay, so the for all of the linguistic similarities and structural similarities, the Al Hanisim is significant because they're actually describing two very different threats. So again, the threat in Purim was quite clear. It's what they call today... an existential threat, right? Which means a threat on the existence of the Jewish people, And the threat on Hanukkah was not Lahashmid La Rogula Vedas Kol Hayudim Minar Vadzakain, right, total destruction, but Lashkicham Tarasachol Avira Mechu Keritzonecha. My argument is that by essentially making it two sides of a coin and framing it with the same original two sentences, Alanis and Galapurkan, with, so to speak, the Chiddush, when you look at it as a total package, is that in fact the Hanukkah is no less. Right, that of course you don't need to justify why the Purim story is very significant salvation, because there could be nothing more basic. If you're dead, that's the ultimate. But the point of putting this right next to the Hanukkah story, right, what emerges from that indisputably is the notion that, right, if they're going to take away Lashkicham Tarasach Lavira Mechu Keritzonecha, that's no less an issue for us. If we can't engage in that lifestyle, so, you know, to quote Rivka in a different context in Sefer Bereishis, if Yaakov will marry one of the local girls, she says, Imlokeach Yaakov Isha Mibnos Cheis Kaelim Mibnos Haaretz, Lama Li Chaim, what's life worth?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay, I mean, obviously it's hard to refute what you're saying, but why can't the text just say that? A spiritual death is as bad as a Purim-like death.
Yeah, and that's a point well taken. If there is a text that says it, I wanted to just bring up the mashal here. Rabbi Kiva has this really... Rabbi Kiva spelled that out. So Rabbi Kiva lived during the 2nd century, the times of the Roman persecutions. So at that time, the Gemara explains that the Romans made a decree that was enforced by the death penalty, that you weren't allowed to teach Torah. So Rabbi Kiva was teaching Torah very publicly. So this guy, Pappas ben Yehuda, went up to him and said, "Are you out of your mind? What are you doing?" And Rabbi Kiva said, "It is dangerous. You can't deny it." He said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Look, it's like the fish. They're a fisherman. And the fox is walking along the side of the river." Fox says, "Like, don't you guys realize the neighborhood's gone bad? There are all these fishing nets. Why don't you come live with me?" So the fish say to the fox, "It's like, they call you the smartest and craftiest of the animals? That's the most foolish thing we ever heard in our lives. Like, you're right. Fishermen might get us. It's dangerous here for us in the water. But better on land?" So Rabbi Kiva's point was, this is our water. We're fish. We live in the water. You give up the Torah, so you'll die, you know, a certain death. You know, here we have to deal with the dangers as they exist. So that's probably the most explicitly we have that idea spelled out. And by the way, you know, it's a good speech, but Rabbi Akiva, he walked the walk also, right? It wasn't just he gave a good speech, but, you know. They actually did. I mean, the interesting thing is I mentioned the guy's name, Pappas ben Yehuda, because they actually end up on death row together. And I think this is probably a general principle, a general life principle. But certainly a Talmudic principle, but I'm pretty sure it's a general life principle. I just don't have the experience, fortunately, to really say it convincingly. But there's no conversation like a death row conversation. And all of those situations in the Gemara are like the best conversations always happen with one or multiple people on death row. So anyway, Pappas ben Yehuda gets thrown into the same cell as Rabbi Kiva. The Gemara doesn't actually specify his crime, but there's an assumption that he basically committed some like petty crime. And Rabbi Kiva looks at him. The last time they spoke is when he was like, "Aren't you, what are you doing?" Rabbi Kiva's like, "What are you in for?" And so he doesn't specify his crime, but he makes it, you know, sort of like between the lines, makes it kind of clear that he's in for some, you know, misdemeanor, but he's going to pay for it with his life. And he says, "Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva shenis pastal divrei Torah. Oy lepapas ben Yehuda shenis pastal dvarim b'telem," that Rabbi Kiva, you're in on a charge that you can take with you to the next world. He said, "I'm here on a petty crime." So anyway, they meet again. Very
well
poignant.
Yeah.
It's a great story. Okay, so That I think is the first critical point, is that the threat on Hanukkah was an existential threat, but of a spiritual nature. Two very minor, somewhat technical points, but I just wanted to. We say this so many times in benching and in davening. It's like it's worth highlighting. So it doesn't say that they just wanted to abrogate the Jewish religion, but there's two specific terms that are used. One is a lahashkicham Torah secha, to cause the Jewish people to forget the Torah.
Yeah.
So this could mean nothing more than simply saying they banned its study. You know, in the Megillas Antiochus, the Megillas Chanukah, which is not canonized, it does, there's a, you know, ban on Jewish education. But the idea of it making people forget, I always thought was suggestive of this idea that they were hopeful that the Jews would sort of be attracted by something else.
Right.
Right, to say, oh, well, you know, let me use this as a crass analogy. She'll make you forget about that last, you know, it's like, you've moved on to something else. So I just think like that's the, there's an insinuation that they had this idea that they had something better to replace it with, which we know conforms to the general idea. It wasn't like the Greeks were saying, you know, like, we don't have any ideas, but we're against yours, or they had a very robust culture. That was point number one. The second thing is lahaviram mechukei ritzonecha. They were particularly offended by the chukim. Chukim meaning the non-logical. Right. Which I think is also consistent with what we know about their culture. That things that were based in reason. It wasn't like they were saying, you know, the Jewish court system, they only accept two witnesses. You know, gosh darn it. You know, that there's a rational basis for that, right? It's a greater veracity than what, no, why I don't require three witnesses already. That might be somewhat formalistic. But the particular antipathy that was had towards the chukim, you know, again, in the aforementioned Megillas Chanukah, so you see they were very, very upset about Bris Mila, they worshipped the human body, Yamim Tovim, etc., etc. So those things that were ritualistic in nature were bothersome to them, as opposed to those aspects of Judaism that would be functional or utilitarian. So the chukim in particular. Yeah.
That makes sense, because that would be a reminder of the divine as opposed to something that could be divine but could also just be for logic, orderly civilization, which would be...
Yeah, you said it much better than I did. Exactly right. And they wouldn't be offended by the idea that, oh, so the Jews have their system of civil law. Because they assumed that every society needed to have that, and that was absolutely fine. That could be, yeah, very well said. Okay, so now just back into the Ahanism for Hanukkah, now that we've sort of laid the groundwork, there's a couple of points I wanted to pick up. So, Ar, if you don't mind just going back to
So where does this text come from?
The texts are written by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, so say the rabbis, let's say very loosely speaking, the rabbis of the Second Commonwealth, the period of Bayis Sheni, are the ones who put these texts together.
Okay. So, Va'ata berachamecha rabim, you with great mercy, amadet alahem be'etzaratam, stood up for them in their time of need. Raftad rivam, fought their fight. Dantad dinam, judged their judgment. Nakamtet nikmatam, you know, accomplished their revenge for them.
Right.
Or avenged their cause. Masarta giborim biyad halashim, so you helped the weak defeat the strong. Rabim miyad ma'atim, and the many were put in the hands of the few.
Right. So those are like military terms, right?
Yeah.
That they were objectively more qualified from a military point of view. Let's say
right. So
Greek Syrian armies were better trained, right? That would be one thing. And then also that not only were they qualitatively superior, there's the quantitative edge that just had many, many more. We're talking about, according again to the Megillas Chanukah, a few hundred soldiers Maccabim had, but they were dwarfed by both the professionalism and the numbers of the Greeks. So these two terms are reflect the military aspect of the situation.
And then the next parts are almost like the rationale.
Yeah, okay, very good.
So then it says, Urushayim biyad sadikim. I'm sorry.
Utsmeim.
Utsmeim biyad sahorim. Urushayim biyad sadikim. Vizeidim biyad oske toratach in the hands of those who study Torah.
Right, so again, now here you have this spiritual contrast. So those who were tamei, the contaminated, defiled, were given over into the hands of those who are pure, wicked into the hands of the righteous. And this is maybe the most interesting one, the Zedim. It was like the brazen ones.
Is it the same shurish as like when you say someone did something with bemazed, like purposely instead of accidentally?
Correct. That they knew what they were doing. They knew the rebellious nature of what they were doing, and they were handed over into the hands of those who study the Torah. Oske Torah Secha. And again, that's meant to be a contrast with Lashkicham Torah Secha. Right? And it's, we haven't forgotten. On the contrary, we're knee-deep. We're immersed. One further nuance. This thought is very interesting that in adjacent sentences, God's mercy is invoked, but also His justice. V'ata b'rachamecha rabim, which appears both in the Al Nisim of Hanukkah and the Al Nisim of Purim, so that we perceive this as an act of divine mercy. We'll see the Rambam actually mentions that in particular, is in his presentation of Hilchos Hanukkah. So the divine aspect of divine mercy, but then in the next sentence, it's din, it's justice. And often we perceive these as contrasts. Anybody ever thought about that? It's how could it be both? If it was divine mercy, then it wasn't necessarily just.
In the simplest sense, it was mercy for us, and it was judgment meted out towards them.
And I think that's very well taken. When you say it's justice meted out towards them.
Meaning like, it's always like, it was good for me, and it was bad for him if I went
across
the case against someone else. So,
I see.
And it's even in the presentation, it's saying, you know, that you did this. Where's the phrase again? Danta et dinam nakanta et nikmatam. It's like the judgment is against our enemies.
So I
in some ways, isn't judgment almost like that always, right? Like if, and let's just say good justice, right? It's like, it's sort of like, it is sort of mercy for the victim. It's like, oh, finally the victim, you know, is avenged.
Yeah, so I really agree with what both of you are saying. It took me a while to try to clarify in my mind, because it was a little bothersome to me, just from a purely logical standpoint, if something, I defer to Howard's philosophy major, but it was bothersome to me, how could it really be both mercy and justice at once? But then I thought back to this pasuk and the Bris Ben Abisarim that we were actually looking at not too long ago. So, God says to Avram, Yado teda ki ger yezarecha be'eretz lo lahem, exile, v'avadum v'inu osam arba me'os shana, and there's going to be 400 years of suffering and persecution. Fine. And in the end, v'gamis ha'goy asher yavodu, the nation that you will be indentured to, the nation that you will be enslaved to, Dan Anochi, I will judge them. So that got me thinking, and I think this is substantively what Ari, what you were saying a second ago, that from our standpoint, it's not as if we were so deserving such that it would be an act of divine justice that we would be liberated. No, from our restricted perspective, it was certainly divine compassion. However, vis-a-vis the Greeks and what they deserved, it wasn't like they were so righteous that they deserved, you know, the upper hand. So it was justice vis-a-vis them. In other words, it's a question of perspective. So, Atah b'rachamecha harabim, you in your abundant mercy, amad talahem, for the Jews, be'es tzarasam, ravta es rivam, you fought on behalf of them. Danta es dinam, not so much you gave them, the Jews, a judgment, but you settled the Jews' account with the Greeks, so that at once it's both an act of compassion for the Jews, but justice vis-a-vis the oppressors of the Jews, because it wasn't as if they were like, you know, the paragons of morality. I'll just note in this context that one of the major aspects of the Hanukkah story is the fact that they were, and again, not only persecuting religiously, but taking very significant liberties with respect to Jewish women. The Rambam cites that in particular, Pashtu Yadam Bimamonam Uvivno Sehen, the Midrashim of Hanukkah and the Megillas Antiochus go into great detail about how there was just mass rape, and in a very cynical way, the Megillah records that the very daughter of Matisyahu Kohen Gadol, meaning the sister of Yehuda HaMakabi and Shimon Elazar, Yonasan and Yochanan HaMakabi, she tore off her clothes at her own wedding, and it was like a scandal, and says that her brothers were aghast, mortified. She said, you're embarrassed by this, but what you should really be embarrassed by is the fact that you're going to hand me over tonight, because that was the Greek policy, to some Greek, you know, animal who's, you know, going to rape me, and, you know, you're okay with that. Why don't you go fight them? And then she has this real zinger at the end. She says, you know, Shimon and Levi, when their sister was taken advantage of, they were two, and they went and fought a whole city, and you guys are five, and you didn't do anything. So, yeah.
So she was well educated.
Snap.
Yeah, right.
And not afraid to let you know what you're right. Exactly. So that's part of the reason that women are obligated in the Hanukkah candles, is afhein hayu bosones, according to many, that they were the driving force behind the miracle in many different ways.
Where is that quote?
So that, afhein hayu bosones, Shabbos 23a.
Okay.
Yeah. The question is, what does it mean that they were also included? So Rashi happens to cite this idea of the Jewish women were being raped upon, you know, being married, which, by the way, which is a widely practiced, you know, throughout the Middle Ages by different cultures. I mean, brutal in all places, but okay. So again, vis-a-vis the Greeks, it's danta es dinam. You know, it wasn't like they were more deserving. Okay, so v'zeidim biado es ketarasacha, and now here come to a critical part. Ari ulecha asisa
ulecha asida shem gadol v'kadosh ba'olamecha.
So in a phrase, how would you?
Basically, God's name came out great, was sanctified in the process.
So what do we usually call that?
Kiddush Hashem.
Yeah, so this was a Kiddush Hashem. So the military victory was a Kiddush Hashem, and the idea appears to be, if the Jews are victorious, postulate A, postulate B, God is always associated with the Jewish people, you know, through thick and thin, then C, what emerges is that God has been sanctified. God is victorious. Divine values are victorious. So Lecha Asis Hashem Gadol, God's name is exalted, Vikadosh, and sanctified. So great and sanctified in the world.
L'amcha Yisrael.
Which follows naturally, right? That it's your nation, right? Then your people are...
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's easy to see that from the inverse. When you say, like, look at that person who's seemingly so holy, but... So, I don't even mean like an Eov type of thing, but just like you almost don't believe that like they're God's people if they'd be suffering so much.
Right. Well, actually, mind you, that was the major argument of the church, is that the church said that veritas Israel, the true Israel, couldn't be the Jews because look at how they live. That's why the church is veritas Israel, the true Israel. Israel is the chosen people for sure. The question is, who's Israel?
La'amcha Yisrael, and so the Jewish people had a more practical result. Asita tshuva gedola, a big salvation. Uporkan, another word for salvation.
Yeah, that's the Aramaic word.
Redemption. Or porkan.
Like Alanis Vialak Virosel.
Kehayom Azeh is a weird phrase. phrase here, like this day.
Yeah.
I mean, normally, you'd almost think it would mean, like, until this day, which is sort of the opposite of what actually happened here.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It was slightly a transit, you know, as you talked about last year, like, it only lasted for, was it 150 years, or...
Yeah, the Rambam says just over two centuries. So that this is generally understood to mean ki hayom hazeh, as clear as today is today. Okay. Yeah, but...
Va'achar kein ba'u banecha l'dvir beitecha, and afterwards your children came to the inside of the temple.
And again, banecha, they're like, you know, they're your children. They're inextricably associated with you, which is how the Kiddush Hashem happened to begin with. They came to the inner sanctum, to your what we normally call the Beis HaMikdash.
Upinu atechalacha, they cleaned it out, v'tiharu at mikdashacha, and they made it pure. V'hidliku neirot b'chatzrot kachacha, they lit candles in the courtyards, the holy courtyards. V'kavu shmonat yimei Chanukah elo, they set these 8 days, lehodot ulehalel l'shimcha hagadol, to give thanks and praise to your great name.
Right, so that we say hallel these 8 days... Right, in the Al Hanisim, Lahodos, in the Thanksgiving section of the Shmon Esrei, L'Shimcha Hagadol, which essentially means, again, if you had to link that back to an earlier expression in the Al Hanisim, that we'll give praise and thanks to your great name, that what are we then doing? Sort of
Kiddush Hashem.
Yeah. So that's the overarching theme, is Kiddush Hashem. That's what Hanukkah is about.
Which fits with Persume Nisa.
Oh, the Persume Nisa is actually just a, I always think, like a fancy way of saying it. It's a very particular form of a Kiddush Hashem. Persume Nisa is,
You publicize a miracle. You could have publicized something else great about God, and that would be a different Kiddush
Hashem. Right, precisely. I completely see things that way. And that we don't often in our minds think of it, but... The truth of the matter is that that's what presuming, that's why presuming Nisa, as we'll see, is given such priority in halacha, like far in excess of what you would normally expect it to be. You know, the Gemara talks about the mitzvah of the Hanukkah candle, which is rabbinic, trumping Doraisa level mitzvah of Kiddush on Shabbos. So that becomes much more understandable if you understand that Ner Chanukah isn't really a mitzvah derabanan; it's a rabbinic application of a very significant Torah level concept, which is rabbinic dashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. That it's really an expression of sanctification of God's name. And there's a lot of there's a lot of evidence for that general idea, which is not our topic for now. But I think that that idea is a very logically compelling idea, right? It's not like, oh, you know, we're doing this in isolation and we're not making some kind of a broader statement, right? It's like if somebody were to go to the Chicago Cubs, you know, World Series victory parade, Bimheira V'Yameinu, you know, and was like, you know, celebrating fanatically, and somebody went up to them and said, oh, so you must be a Cubs fan. And the person said, no, I'm just celebrating the World Series. It's like a funny, right? By definition, they're making a broader statement about their general loyalties, right? You can't, you know, near Hanukkah, you can say, oh, I'm just doing this isolated mitzvah. Of course it has, right, a valence, and it reverberates on the level of making a broader statement about commitment and... God's role in the world. So that's exactly the point that I wanted to try to develop through one passage in the Gemara and then two passages in the Rambam. So the Gemara says the following. Remember, Hanukkah is not treated in the Mishnah in any direct way. It comes up a very ancillary way in Bikurim, that one is permitted to bring Bikurim up until Hanukkah, even though one is not permitted to recite the formula of Bikurim after Sukkot. My Hanukkah. So what is it? Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in the Braisa, Bechav Hei BeKislev, starting on the 25th day of the month of Kislev, Yomei DeChanukah Timnaya Inun, the days of Chanukah are 8, Timnaya is Shmona, Inun means day, 8 days of Chanukah, and they're defined as days Delo L'Misbeid Behon U'Delo L'Hisanos Behon. One can't eulogize and one doesn't fast. They're days whose essence is incompatible with either eulogy or fasting. Sheh, why? Why is the halacha that you can't eulogize or fast on those days? Shek shenichnasu yevanim lehechal. When the Greeks, again, from the perspective of the Gemara, the whole story is about the Beis HaMikdash. So when the Greeks went into the sanctuary, timu kol hashmanim shebahechal. So they defiled all of the oils. And if you ask me, I can't swear to it, but it sounds like it was deliberate, right? Like, it sounds like this was, like, they went in there and ransacked the shul. Ukshegavra malchus beis chashmonai. And when the Jews gained the upper hand, right, you almost have to introduce the chashmonaim in an ancillary way just to get to the story of the oil, but, right, nothing like about their military prowess or anything, you know, like, you know, certainly no story about their sister shaming them, you know, it's like, right, just bare bones. Ukshegavra malchus beis chashmonai, when they gained the upper hand, vinitzchum, and they won a military victory, which is certainly besides the main point. Badku, they checked, v'lo matzu ala pach echad shel shemen. They found a pach is, I put down here vessel for lack of a better term. I'm not fully satisfied with that, but a pach is like, sometimes it's translated as a jug, but it's a small container of oil. It's meant to be a small unit. Okay, pach echad shel shemen, shahaya munach bechosamo shel kohen gadol. It was sealed. You know, the way that we would have a hashkacha today. It was sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Vilohaya bow, and this vessel only had Ela Lahabdik Yom Echad. It had a quantity of one day's oil, which, by the way, it makes a lot of sense if you were lighting the menorah. It's a very logically sized amount. It's so you'd make, you know, you'd want to produce, just from the perspective of being user-friendly, you want to produce, like, oh, you have today's jug. So, like, you know, if you're giving a kid snack at camp, so you give them a little orange juice that they're going to drink, not a carton. So it's just like, it makes a lot of sense. So it was,
except today that's really a candle's worth of oil. But back in the day.
Back in the day,
right. Day's worth of oil.
Nase bones, and there was a miracle with this vessel, with this pach. V'hiliku mimenu shmona yamim. They were able to light from it for 8 days, which basically, they kept on going back to this vessel, this jug, and it just somehow kept on filling itself up with oil. So that's the way, it's as if this was the, you know, it had 1 day's oil, and we took it all out on the first day. Then the next day, you know, they filled it up from it again. Then it was sort of like this self, you know, regenerating vessel of oil. So when I remember when I was taught the story, you know, it was, I got a different version. Is that like somehow the candles lasted, the flames,
right,
lasted for 8 days? But right, the simple pshat in the Gemara is certainly not that way, and most Rishonim understand it, that the miracle wasn't nase bo nes v'hidliku mimenu, from this pach shmona yamim. They were able to light from it all 8 days, which is makes a lot of sense for the way that we practice the mitzvah, that there we light all 8 days, right? If the miracle was really that it lasted for 8 days, I always thought it was like a little funny that, like, oh, we're celebrating this amazing miracle and we're highlighting the fact that we don't have that miracle by, now we've got to relight the candles, right? It's sort of like this ironic, but if they really did,
you're saying they didn't ration out the oil?
Doesn't sound that way. It sounds like that they, that some people say, oh, what this means is that they took 1/8 of the
amount.
But it never made sense to me, because if they, why would they have done that? That means that they could have never even done the menorah once, because that would, they would have only tried to light one candle.
Where do we learn about the duration? I'm sure I learned it, but I don't, how long a candle has to burn today, like 45 minutes or
yeah,
more.
The Gemara tries to figure that out. Yeah. The Gemara says that Mishatishka hachama jitachala regel minashuk, until people basically weren't outdoors anymore. Remember, they didn't have electricity, so
right,
when it got dark, that was it. Nobody was outside.
Right, but it was there any sense that in the days of the Beit HaMikdash that the menorah had burned for like...
Oh, yeah. The menorah
night,
was supposed
or...
to last... Right, exactly. It was supposed to last as long as the longest winter night. That's correct. Lele Tevis.
So that's not something we try to replicate.
No, definitely.
No, I know practically not.
So it is really interesting. It sounds like, right, that they were able to light from this vessel 8 days in a row. But they lighted, you know, or they lit, rather, 8 days. So l'shana acheres, the next year, or in a subsequent year, meaning, it, the Rambam says, in that generation, meaning not so long, 50 years later, 10 years later, whatever it was, l'shana acheres, another year, but another year sometime within reason, kiva'um, they institutionalized, like keva, v'asa'um, Yamim Tovim Bahalo Vehoda, that these will be days of praise and thanksgiving. Not Yom Tov in the sense that there will be an Isser Malacha, it's not a real Yom Tov, but it's 8 days that are consecrated on the calendar for Halel of Hashem and Hoda of Hashem. Again, which is a form of being Mekade Shem Shamayim. So this is the Gemara's presentation. No emphasis whatsoever on the military victory. It's completely ancillary. The point is that the oil lasted for 8 days from this Pach Echad Shel Shemen, the Neis HaPach, as we often call it, and that the response wasn't to institutionalize the lighting of Hanukkah candles, but to mark off these 8 days as days of praise and thanksgiving, that the basic theme of these days is later on, the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles developed, but the basic theme is sanctification of God's name through Hallel and Hodah. The Rambam has an altogether different presentation of the Hanukkah story, which focuses much more on the national and military element, but I'm interested in just drawing out one point today to really focus in on, I think, how the Rambam was able to get to the heart of the matter. Just for pedagogical purposes, maybe we'll skip over the middle Rambam. We'll read that last. I actually decided I want to do the last Rambam first, the third source here on this page. So the Rambam is discussing the concept of Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name. And the Rambam says the following four things in this order. He says, "Okay, Kol Beis Yisrael Mitzuvin al Kiddush Hashem Agadol Hazeh. The entire Jewish people are responsible to make a Kiddush Hashem. Men, women, children, everybody." Mm-hmm. And it's a defining characteristic of the Jewish people. It's defining. It is absolutely essential to our mission. So how do you do that? So the Rambam says the first thing that you do is you choose life. So that if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, do an Aveira, you choose life, because that's how you're Mekadesh Hashem. Unless you're dealing with something which is so severe that life really is no longer worth living, if you're going to have to kill somebody or commit an act of sexual immorality or an act of idolatry, fine. That's often what we call the big three. The Rambam says, and there's one other exception, which is if you're in front of 10 other Jews and the person who's trying to force you to do the Aveira is really trying to get you to make a religious statement, you'd have to give up your life, and that would be Kiddush Hashem in that context. Then the Rambam says, oh, well, there's one more exception. And this is the one more exception. This is the most fascinating exception, because it seems to turn the general rule on its head, and now the Rambam is asking you to give up your life, not just for the big three, or not just in public, but for anything. So the Rambam says the following. V'chol advarim ha'elu, everything that I just went through a second ago, shalo b'shas hashmad, is not in a time of destruction. L'hashmid, Ari, you read before from the Al-Hanisim of Purim, Lashmid La Rogulab. Lashmid means to destroy. So Shas Hashmad means a time literally of religious destruction. It's just interesting that the term Lashmid has a physical meaning, like to kill all the Jews, and Shas Hashmad is a time of spiritual. Aval Bishas Hashmad, Vihu, what does that mean? Kishayamod Melech Rasha. So a wicked king or an empire, like Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonian Empire, v'chaverav, I wrote here, and his ilk, right? Somebody of that nature, yigzor shmad al Yisrael, will declare destruction upon the Jewish people, levatel dasam, to nullify their religion, oh mitzvah min ha-mitzvos, or even to just do a full assault on one particular mitzvah. But again, it's not as if this non-Jew put a gun to your head and said, I want you to do this avera in a completely lone wolf, idiosyncratic way, but they were part of a sovereign program of eradication of the Jewish religion. Yehareg ve'al yavor. You have to be prepared to sanctify God's name by giving your life. You should be killed rather than violate. Afilo alachas mishar mitzvos. Even if you're talking about one of the other mitzvos, meaning not idolatry or murder or an act of sexual immorality. Beinenas besochasar, whether you're being coerced publicly. Beinenas beino levein agayim, or whether you're being done around no other Jews. Now let's take a look at the Rambam's presentation of Hilchos Chanukah. I just think there's something very original in the Rambam's presentation and almost unmistakable when you have this previous Rambam in the background. Bibayis Sheni, during the time of the Beis HaMikdash Sheni, the Second Temple, Kishemalchu Yavan, when the Greek Empire was sovereign, Gazru Gzeros al Yisrael Ubitlu Dasam. They made decrees against the Jewish people and they nullified the Jewish religion. Vilohinichu Osam La'asok B'Torah V'Mitzvos. They didn't permit study of Torah or performance of mitzvos, etc., etc. And then, of course, there was the financial element, and then there was Bivno Sehen, alluded to before. And yes, then they went into the Beis HaMikdash and they defiled the Beis HaMikdash. Vitzar lahem liYisrael meod mipneihem. It was a time of national distress. Ulechatzum lachatz gadol. There was intensive pressure. Ad shirichem aleihem Elohei avoseinu vehoshiyeh miyadam. God had mercy. So it seems pretty clear to me that the Rambam is basically saying that Chanukah was a shas hashmad, which means that the order of the day, like the basic mitzvah of Chanukah, then the response has to be Kiddush Hashem. So when you approach it from that angle, that what we're really trying to do is Kiddush Hashem, sanctify God's name, by saying this is the most important thing, and that what we will react with absolute uncompromising commitment when you try to take away our religion, that is essentially the story of Chanukah. And I think that might help explain a couple of things. First of all, we saw in the Al Hanisim a very strong emphasis on this very thing, Kiddush Hashem. It helps us understand the role of Hallel on Chanukah. It's a particular form of Kiddush Hashem. It helps us understand why the Rambam describes Neiros Chanukah as mitzvah Chaviva Hi Ad Me'od, incredibly beloved. Or it's the mashal I like to give is, if God forbid a parent almost loses a child, what does a parent do? Hugs the child. He'll never let go of you. And that's sort of the way that we treat the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, right? Just mahadrin imina mahadrin, the highest possible level with all of the hidurim, because we're defying their desire to take it away. Everybody has to participate, even the poorest of Jews. Afilu ani shebi Yisrael. The Rambam says, big chiddush, that even the most impoverished Jew would have to participate, sell the shirt off his back. It's not just a mitzvah derabban, it's kiddush Hashem. It's a response to shas hashmad. And if that's the case, then we know that there are both verbal and nonverbal expressions of that. The halal is a very verbal, clearly articulated way of saying God is great, but when we light the Chanukah candles, that itself is a non-verb. You know, not everything important in life is said. Some of it is just communicated, right? And that's true also. So I think that helps us understand what becomes so vital and so, as the Rambam says, mitzvah ner Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi ad ma'od. The chavivas of Ner Chanukah, v'chayev adam li'zayir ba, and the care that we have to take with respect to Chanukah candles is something that really emerges from Kiddush Hashem. So I just think that's a something that is one of those aspects of our tradition that we really can't emphasize enough and we can't think about enough. And to have a very powerful sense that everything that we do is a reflection on our association with God. There's a very strong proprietary connection God has with us, and Ner Chanukah is the particular referendum on that. And it's these 8 days is a time to think about Kiddush Shem Shamayim in all of our activities.
And do you think that's hard?
Let's put it this way.
On Hanukkah.
I think that if somebody had a very prestigious professional affiliation or social affiliation, they would, you know, rightly relate to that with a great deal of pride. What I do wish we were better able to sense, and not just to give it lip service, but to really sense and educate towards, it was the same way that any one of our children, again, had that kind of prestigious professional affiliation or educational affiliation or, you know, whatever you want to fill in, you know, they went to the University of Chicago or something, they'd be proud of that. So for them to have this deep sense of pride, not in your face, but like quiet pride in belonging to this very powerful legacy. We were talking about that in particular last night with Michaela, with when it comes to Jewish women. The refrain happens three times in the Shas, Afhein Hayu Ba'oso Hanes, in Pesach, Purim, Chanukah, that in moments of national crisis, you know, destiny-defining moments. So Jewish women have, whether it's Esther or the Nashim Tzidkaniyos that the Gemara refers to, the generation of Egypt, or in the Chanukah story, this Chana that we were talking about, or Yehudis, there's a Jewish woman that sort of rises to the moment, carries the day, and these girls have a sense of, now you belong to this, I wouldn't call it a fraternity, but a sorority, right, if you will. So to have that, I think it's, I don't know if it's hard, but I just think that our senses are dulled towards it, and to have this very deep sense of pride and pride of place in this grouping, and that we should carry that with great significance, and that we see all of our actions in public and in private as a referendum on the extent to which we value that affiliation, that it would be.
So this is why I ask you. I think I'm probably even wrong in this. I think Hanukkah is one of the easiest.